obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
My name is Dick Anderson and I am an alcoholic. My home group is the Macklin Group in Powder Springs, Georgia. We meet on Thursday night. Now, I'll mention this. I got cancer a few years ago. We had to move to out in the country, and looked for a meeting, couldn't find one that I liked. Didn't find any that were exactly what I wanted, but the Big Book says that we can find what we want, and we can help improve those meetings, and that's exactly what I did, and I started with a meeting that had about 10 people, and wasn't a good meeting, bad meeting. They were nice people, just not much going on, but... But they were nice people and active members, and so I got involved in it. And after a while, we started having group conscious meetings, and I volunteered to be a greeter, and they laughed at that because there were only 10 of us. But but we started doing all the things that people did when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and now 5 years later, we have 200 people, and we have. We had so many newcomers trying to share at the big meeting that we started a steps 1 through 3 meeting in one room, then a steps 4 through 9 meeting in another room, and then you can come out to the big meeting and share. And that's on Thursday night. On Monday, on Saturday night, we've got a 12-step and a 12 tradition. We have a tradition 1 week and the parallel tradition and step the next week. On Saturday night and on Monday night, they have a women's meeting. I have no idea what the hell they do in there. But you're welcome anytime you come. I was part of the group that put in the bid for, I was a delegate back then when we put in the bid for the International 2015. I've been to 7 internationals. And I will say, this is the closest I've ever been to any AA event to an international. If you haven't been, they have all of the different countries bring out their flags, and they parade them like you have the group flags. And I never go to one that I don't cry at the opening ceremony and cry at the ending ceremony and meet lots and lots of people from all over the world in between. So you don't want to miss it. We have 11 acres and a lake. So between boats, houseboats, whatever you want to bring, you're welcome to stay with us. So. And I want to say, I wasn't expecting what happened this morning. I wasn't really expecting what's been happening this whole weekend. I've probably been to 500 or 600 conferences over the time I've been in the program. And what was going on when people walked in here this morning, where people were singing and people were celebrating a new life. In the last few years, I lost my best friend, Keith Lewis, who... I had spoken here before, but in the last few months, I lost my sponsor, who was 91, and my dad. And I would like to think that where they went, they were greeted the same way we were greeted this morning when we walked in here. As Mike said, we've been in California for about a week. I'm a writer, so I've been out here more than a few times, but Barbara and I, this trip was primarily for AA and Al-Anon, and we got to go to Palmdale, is where we spoke on the Friday night. Emily and I spoke at a meeting over there. We did a workshop on Saturday, but we've stayed in Westwood, Como Estad, but it's Costa Mesa. And then moved here to Torrance, and we've had a wonderful time. But I do have some questions. I'm a car nut. I have seen more expensive $400,000 cars that can do 180 miles an hour sitting next to me going 5 on the 405. I'm not sure what the deal is on that. Another question, we were out here and we went to lunch yesterday. I picked up a newspaper and it's LA Weekly and the cover says, Vegans for Satan. Are these people that sacrifice carrots?
Yeah.
This is a weird place. I'm sure you know that. And just from the conference this weekend, I've noticed that you have an extremely abundant amount of very large, bald guys. I've never seen so many. Yeah, exactly. I don't know what the deal is, but looks like they're all having fun. So Barbara and we have been treated absolutely royally since we've been here. Mike and Emily have been terrific hosts. Larsine, who is my favorite Al-Anon speaker, besides my wife, Barbara, was... No, I must say that. I must. But... I love Larsine. We get to speak at conferences together, and I think she's the one to put my name in the hopper, and I appreciate this. This is a gift. We've had Kathy stayed in touch. Absolutely. We got here. We got those great big 230-pound gift baskets that were all loaded up for us. And I have a short memory. I don't have a short memory about what I did in the eighth grade, but I have a short memory about what happened a month ago. And until Larry reminded me, I'd forgotten we filled out a form about what we like to eat and drink. But they brought this, and everything I would have bought was in there. So we were thinking this had to do with this NSA read your mail thing, because I drink Diet Cherry Dr. Pepper and Diet Fruit Punch Powerade mixed together, and I thought, now who would arbitrarily just buy those? And then Larry, who is Larry and I are blood. We're in the same sponsorship family for a while, and friends in Atlanta. And he reminded me that we had gotten that questionnaire. So you know, if you wait long enough, it doesn't matter how long you're in the program, you'll get the answer. So anyway, but Kathy has been wonderful all the way. And then this is the way, you know, I love people who are smart alecks and genuinely kind people, and that describes Dave. And he doesn't want anybody to know that he's actually a nice person, but we check in here, and I'll talk about it later in my talk. But I had what was called terminal cancer about 7 years ago. The people that described as terminal were not aware of the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, and so that was 7 years ago. I've been cancer free for 7 years, and but they did change my body. I don't have an upper digestive system like you do. They took all mine out and put in a new one, and I was on a feeding tube for a couple of years, so I have to live differently, and I sleep sitting up. And so we had to have a little room with the only places here are those little hospitality suites, and we had to have one, and the hotel got a little confused, and we didn't have one the first night we got here, and Dave was there at the front desk and just to help us out, and he found out what was going on, and he checked out of his room. He was staying in one of those suites, moved into a regular room just so we could have it. And that's the kind of love and care you get when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I've enjoyed all the speakers this weekend. Cartoon, which I think is a great name. We had, and I qualified for most of the meetings. I'm a veteran. I have no feeling on my lower right front leg from where I laid my Triumph 650 into a Ford Galaxy, so I qualify for the bikers meeting. I was a musician at one time, so, and we've enjoyed the whole weekend and all the speakers. I had never heard Corey before from Wetumpka, but let me tell you something. She's not from Wetumpka. Alabama is Wetumpka. She does not sound like a Wetumpka, and I found out later she's from Canada originally. But with Tompkins sound, they're in Alabama, they have their own accent. And all of the speakers and spending time with Larry. And then this morning, for those of you who missed it, it was a powerful meeting because Jean, and I had heard her husband before, and her granddaughter, Molly, and there was an Alateen Priscilla, but when they spoke, they were sharing about a family where 50 people were involved in this, and AA and Al-Anon had blessed them so deeply that there was no way to describe the joy that was in that meeting. And I thank you for that. That was beautiful. When I got sober, I got sober in Louisville, Kentucky, and that was my sobriety date. It's June the 8th, 1977. So I celebrated 36 years last month. And at the time I got sober, we had an AA meeting on one side of the church, an Al-Anon meeting on the other side of the church, and an Alateen meeting every other night. And we had speaker meetings, so we didn't have a lot of discussion. The discussions took place at the Howard Johnson's afterwards. And we got to know the families, and I just always thought it was family recovery. And if you're a new alcoholic, the best way to find out what kind of damage you did is listen to the Alateen and the Al-Anon speakers. And so it was a way for me to accept responsibility for what I had done. But then those same people would love me and hug me and tell me they were glad to see me, and it was a way of being forgiven. And almost everything I've done in life, I've done first in AA and learned how to do it out there, even with my family. And that taught me that I felt forgiven. I felt I could go back to my own family, and I could start to make amends there. And it was a real blessing. And the idea of family recovery is not something that's celebrated every place, as we've gotten away from it somewhat in the fellowship. But I am so grateful for the fact that you are doing that, and I thank you again for that. So, and I appreciate the fact that you did a veterans meeting. We had a speaker who was a POW, and I had two tours in Vietnam. I just didn't happen to I had a greater fear of being captured than I did of being shot. He spoke, and there was a great depth in what he shared. And then when you recognize the veterans at the beginning of this, it was a big thing for us. And I'll start with my actual story, because my family is the family that I come from, is not a family of wealth. We're a family of honor. When I was in the 7th, 8th, 9th grade, I went to a high school for smart kids because I was smart back then. And it was in a district where there were a lot of kids who had money, and my family has never had a lot of money. And I felt ashamed of the fact that I didn't come from one of those families with money. And now I feel differently because I've come to actually appreciate and honor my family. My name is Richard Jefferson Anderson, the first one of us, and my great-great-great-great-grandfather was Richard Clough Anderson. He was the Captain Dick Anderson of the first boat across the Delaware on Christmas Day of 1776. He became a general at Valley Forge. His grandson was General Dick Anderson, Richard Heron Anderson, who served under Robert E. Lee at Gettysburg. He was a West Point grad, and his cousin from the same was Robert Anderson, who was the commander of Fort Sumter when the first shot was fired of the Civil War. My dad is one of the most decorated World War II pilots, was given the Army Cross, which is like the Navy Cross, several Distinguished Flying Crosses, was shot down behind Nazi lines, brought his crew back out. My sister is a retired Byrd colonel. Her husband is a retired Byrd colonel. Their boy graduated from West Point. Of the grandkids, we've got a West Pointer, and we've got two or three Green Berets and a Marine. I obviously did not fit into this family. The best way to describe it, I'm kind of like Forrest Gump and Lieutenant Dan's family. Except without the focus or integrity. All I can remember from the very beginning is, you know, Dad in the flight suit, he's come back, and and I forgot to mention Terry. I was absolutely touched by your talk last night. That was a beautiful talk. But my dad would come back, and he would come, and he would bring us stuff, except that nobody in my family, I'm the first alcoholic of record. He came home as soon as he could, and he'd lift us up, and he'd have something for us, and everybody, all my aunts, uncles, everybody's in uniform. They're all going off to war back and forth, World War II, Korea. And so that's the family that I grew up in. I faked it. I pretended to be like the rest of them, but I really wasn't. I had no idea what service was. I had no idea what honor was. I was fearful that I knew that I couldn't be like them, and so I felt separated from people. So that was my first thing. I never felt close to people. I felt I had trouble being intimate with anybody. I had trouble talking to anybody. I did all the things. I played baseball. I was in music. I went to school. I did all those things, but I didn't fit in. And so I went that way. My family was also a family of faith. They weren't dogmatic about it, but they believed in it, and they did pray, and they believed that there was a God, and they believed we were here to serve people. Same thing that I'm learning in Alcoholics Anonymous. My family knew automatically and behaved that way. And so I didn't feel like I fit in. I didn't feel close. I couldn't tell my Little League coach any of the activities I was involved in told me the same thing that AA does. I was involved in Little League, 4-H, YMCA, Boy Scouts. Boy Scout Handbook says the way we please God best is to do something each day kind for another person anonymously. And that's what we do in AA. I didn't get it in Boy Scouts. It didn't get to me. And so we went to church. We went to 4-H. All of those things taught me the same thing. I couldn't tell my Little League coach or my the leader at the Y, anybody. I couldn't tell them what was going on with me because I didn't have a sponsor to guide me through anything. So I could talk to somebody. I didn't know somebody. I was supposed to tell somebody what I was feeling. And so I just held it back. I just was stoic. That's the way I deal with things. I call it now my Vietnam mode, but before I did it before I went to Vietnam. I just stiffened up and I pretended to be somebody that I wasn't. But there was an invention that came along about that time that allowed me to actually interact, and this became my reality, and it was a thing called the television. It was a little black and white thing with pictures on there, and there were shows on there, and they were good moral teachers, too. It was Ozzie and Harriet, Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, the Andy Griffith Show. And this became my moral compass. If Opie or Wally ever got off the beam, by the end of the show, Dad had, without judgment, which I really didn't want any judgment. We went to a Baptist church when I was young and then transferred to Presbyterian. But the Baptist, we had judgment there, and I didn't want any judgment. But in those scenes, Opie or Wally, Dad would take his pipe, turn it to one side, say something calm, wise, gentle. Opie or Wally got the message, and by the end of the show, they'd figured out how to live. So this became, that's where I, if I had wanted to know how to live, I took it to Opie and Wally to find out what I should do about any occasion, and I felt more comfortable with those characters than I did real life. I get paid, I'm a writer, I get paid to imagine things, and I'm really good in that world. I'm not so good in this world. I have more trouble doing things, managing my money things. Those are things I've had to learn since I got into AA, and that did not learn before. So this was the one place I felt at peace. Now, we went to church, but I felt very separated. The big book says lack of power is our dilemma, and that's what I couldn't articulate that, but I knew my dad and these people were people of power. They were people that had, they were respected, and they did what they were supposed to, and I didn't feel that power. I had none of it. But I thought maybe they got it at church, and I went to the most spiritual thing that happened in my childhood was going to the drive-in. At the East Drive-In, we saw a movie called The Ten Commandments, and up there on the screen was a man who had all kinds of power, and he had his name was Moses, and he had this staff, and he would push it to one side, and the Red Sea would part. And I made two decisions that night. It was at the drive-in with my dad, my mom, my little sister, the soon-to-be-retired bird colonel. We're all out there, and I see this movie, and I see this tremendous power. I had never even seen a film in color, because TV was black and white in those days, and this film was not only in color, it was in Technicolor, and it was 120 feet wide. And I had some kind of experience that night, and I made a decision, two decisions. One, I wanted to be around whatever that was, that film thing up there. And for the last 40 years, I've either made a living or not made a living writing and producing. So God was hearing me, and he had given me some talents to do that. The second decision I made was I wanted to be on God's side because I saw what Charlton Heston had done to Yul Brynner. So the next day, much to the surprise of my mom and dad, who were not aware I was having a spiritual awakening in the back of the 55 Ford, I went down the aisle in the Baptist church and got dipped and dunked. We surrender all was the thing. I was about 3 feet tall. I surrendered all 3 feet of me, my parents, my grandmother was there. They all wondered what had happened to me, and but I was like the newcomer who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought that would give me the same thing my family had. I thought it would give me the same thing that you had if you were sitting there in that church and you were smiling and laughing and enjoying life. I thought it would give me this power. I thought it would give me some answer. But I was like the newcomer who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous and sits in the meetings and doesn't get a sponsor and doesn't work any steps. I didn't change. I didn't do anything to change. I just went. And after a few days, weeks, months, whatever it was, because I didn't change, I was still that scared little Baptist Boy Scout that had walked down that aisle before. and nothing about it was good. And I didn't feel like I'd found an answer, and so I thought God rejected me. I kept hearing in church and other places this term, the chosen ones. And I wasn't obviously one of the chosen ones. Everybody else was. All you guys were chosen ones, but I was not one. And so I'm separated from people before because I feel ill at ease and uncomfortable with people. Now I feel like God doesn't care for me. I never believed that there wasn't a God. I believed that God didn't want me. And that's the way I walk my life. And from that point on, I tried to avoid God as much as possible. But I did it in the same way, you know, if you have a girl and you really got, you know, a crush on her and you do everything you can and you ask her out. And not only does she not go out with you, but she humiliates you by telling you, go out with you. And so that's the way I felt about God, that God had just turned me out. Now, secretly, I still want to go out with that girl. But I'm going to do everything I can to discredit that girl and talk about her and explain what a witch she is and blah. And that's the way I was with God. And when I started drinking, I actually was able to deface a couple of churches and do some things that I had to make later amends for. But I was not happy with God. I was angry at God, and I couldn't understand why God didn't accept me. So this is the way I started off. I had my second spiritual experience when I was 14 years old. We were playing baseball, and the right fielder got us we were camping out at his house before we played the next day. He got a six-pack of beer and a half pint of gin. I drank the beer. He drank the gin. And I don't know how Moses felt, but suddenly I felt like I was about 10 feet tall. The wind was blowing through my hair. I had hair, and I just felt like all of that fear and all of that anxiety just dropped off my back, and I was okay. That was exactly what I was looking for when I went to that church. That was what I was looking for in my family. I fit in. Up until this time, if I talked to you, I was very self-conscious about what I said. Here I was at the drive-in, and we hitchhiked, and from the very beginning, I was not a stay-at-home drunk. I was a go-to-town drunk, and going to town when you're 14 means hitchhiking, and we hitchhiked up to a place called the White Castle. And I don't think they have White Castles out here, but I don't even know what would be similar to it, but it's a place where you go at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're drunk to get a dozen of these little square burgers with 8 million onions on them that seem like a good idea at 3 o'clock in the morning, but not so much the next day. And so we go up to the White Castle. My buddy Dave, I'm having a great time. I discovered table hopping. I'm going around talking to all the adults, introducing myself. I'm 14. I'm flirting with a redhead, a 25-year-old redhead behind the counter, and I'm having the best time I've ever had in my life. I'm free. My buddy Dave's not having the same spiritual experience as I am. Dave was getting a little woozy, and I had never had a cup of coffee either, but I had seen in Perry Mason, if you have too much coffee, if you have too much to drink, you order a cup of coffee, so it'll sober you up so you can talk to the police. So I order a cup for my buddy Dave, and again, it does not have the desired effect. Within a few minutes, Dave hadn't had any coffee before either. Within a few minutes, Dave had thrown up down the stainless steel counter. And it turns out, if you're looking for a Louisville policeman at midnight, the best place to find him is at the White Castle. So they came down and said, what's the matter with your friend? I said, he's just had a little bit too much to drink. Really? How old is he? 14. How old are you? 14. So I was in Louisville City Jail 4 hours after I took my first drink. And that was pretty much the end of my social drinking. I drank as much as I could from that point on. I would have told you when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, my drinking problem started my last 2 or 3 years, and that was when I was drinking nonstop. I had before I got evicted, I had an apartment I wasn't paying the rent on, no furniture in it. It was just a basement apartment. I slept on the bathroom floor. I had a TV that was there. I would get some whiskey down. I would dry heave for a little while. I didn't have any food for my last 2 years. And the only time I left that bathroom was to go up to the liquor store. Eventually, I got evicted from that, and I was out on the street. Then I knew I had a problem. But here's what happened the first 3 times I took a drink. The first time I take a drink, I go to jail in a family where nobody has ever gone to jail. And the only thing I could think about was taking that next drink. The first time for me was the beer. The second time was something I would highly recommend if you're going to have a slip, cherry vodka. And an older boy had gotten it for me. We transferred to this school, and I was the starting quarterback on the JV football team and dressing with the varsity. And He got me the cherry vodka. The third time I took a drink, it was Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey, and that's pretty much what I drank until I got here. I didn't like the taste any of those times, but the proof jumped up, and it got me there that much quicker. I could not care less what kind of vehicle it was in. I just wanted to get that inside me, so I felt that way. The second thing that happened, I had no real intimate friends. I had one person on the planet that I was absolutely infatuated with, in love with. Her name was Belinda. She was the captain of the JV cheerleaders. I talked to her every night on the phone for 2 or 3 hours. We went to movies. We went to hayrides. I was in love with her. You could have been a 350-pound SEC lineman. I would have fought you to the death for this girl. And after she found out about my incident where I got locked up, she said to me on one of our phone calls, "I haven't told you this, but my dad has a drinking problem. When he drinks, he gets mean, and it's not pretty, and I need to ask you not to drink when we go out." And it took me less than 24 hours to break up with the only person in my life that meant anything to me. And I had no idea that alcohol affected my life. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been arrested 22 times. I had been arrested at my senior prom for 2 counts of assault and battery on a police officer. I was 18. Up until that point, they threw me in the juvie tank, but not that night. We have another event that takes place the same time as prom in Louisville, and it's a little horse race that lasts 2 minutes. And so this was Derby weekend, where the proms are on Friday night and the Derby's on Saturday night. Now, I went to a high school with 3,000 people, and 2 of them were black, and I got along with both of them, so I knew all about civil rights. And one of them was I was a quarterback, one of them was a halfback, and his sister. So I knew them, they were fine. And I won't give you their name. I used to actually list the name. Now that guy's in AA. So so I thought I knew all about civil rights. I was locked up, and for those who are old enough, because of the way I drank, my dad had had the talk, "You can't stay in this house and drink like that or act like that." So I had moved out. My junior and senior year, I worked and paid rent and split an apartment with some older kids. And they rarely knew where I was. I'd go back to emotionally blackmail my mother now and then. And the strange thing about saying all this is the one thing that I wanted more than anything in the world was for my mom and dad to be proud of me. And everything I did defeated that. Because once I started drinking, I could care less. So they don't know where I am, but they know I'm going to the prom because my little sister, who's the son that my dad wanted, she's a doctor and a colonel, no financial problems, blah, blah, blah. So she tells my parents that, you know, I'm going to the prom and et cetera. But they found out where I was the next morning, because when I got locked up and thrown in for the first time, the adult felony tank, not even the misdemeanor tank, the felony tank, because of the assault and battery, I was put in there with 7 others. There were 8 bays. And the next morning on, they got to look at all 8 of us, because on ABC, NBC, and CBS, which is all there was in those days, I came out with my 7 cellmates, who were 7 Black Panthers who'd come into Louisville to blow up the Churchill Downs to make a statement. So on ABC, NBC, and CBS, they are the 7 Black Panthers and me. In my little powder blue tuxedo jacket. The biggest problem was that I was chairman of the breakfast committee, and I was apparently in prison while they were having the breakfast. So there I am. Now, to me, this was an adventure. You know, I was good at writing when I was 5 or 10. I mean, this is something I've always been able to do. I was a musician and a writer, and so I knew all the, you know, Hemingway. They were all experiential. He ran with the bulls. He went off to war. He does all this stuff. And so, you know, I get to go, and I get to experience this. How many of these kids, and all they're doing is this mundane stuff like study and getting ready to go to Princeton, Harvard, Yale, Brown. They're doing this, you know, dull stuff. I get to hang out with the Black Panthers for a few hours. And so that's just the way I was. Here was a kid. I made good enough grades to go on my SATs. I took him in the 9th grade. I could have gone to Harvard, Prince, Yale, any place else. but I needed my uncle's help. He was a dean at the University of Kentucky to get into a state school because of my police record. So I go off to University of Kentucky. I was still watching movies a lot, still reading a lot of books. I think the year that I graduated, a film came out called The Graduate. I had made it all the way through college without ever smoking a cigarette. I started smoking after I saw The Graduate 10 times and started smoking cigarettes, and I had an affair with an older woman. She'd be about 89 now. So, but I go down to University of Kentucky. Now, everybody else, there are academies and all this stuff. I'm in ROTC, so if I'd stayed there, I could have gotten a commission. But one night, we were drinking and talking, and somebody had just gotten a new TIAC tape deck. That was the latest invention then, and so we were recording ourselves while we were drinking. And the word over-mesmerized and under-mesmerized was used several times during that discussion, so that gives you the level of academia we were going for. And anyway, all our parents were World War II veterans, and we did not want to miss out on combat, so we decided we would go down the next day and enlist. Forget ROTC. And the next day, out of the five or six of us in that room, there was only one who was still drinking who went down. And how do you make an intelligent selection? The Marine captain recruiter drank the best. So, and as you know, they give you your choice of where you want to go. I put down Key West, Key West, Key West. I got Vietnam, Vietnam, and the Pentagon. Now, I know that you know that Kentucky is kind of a cutting edge of hip. Harlan Sanders, Muhammad Ali. But I had never seen a marijuana cigarette when I went to college. The closest thing we had to it was Rebel Yell, which was a bottle of Stitzel-Weller bourbon with a Confederate flag on it. Yeehaw! And so, so that's all I knew. And I pretty much, it says, we seek out lower companions. I was the lower companion all the way through that period. But I go to Vietnam, and there were people over there doing drugs. And it was the first time I actually felt superior to somebody, because I felt if you were doing drugs, you lacked self-discipline. And I'm not saying I didn't smoke a few joints or accidentally do LSD on a plane ride one time. But I was a wild turkey guy. I was it was the Green Beret, everything about the films where you'd get off a mission and you'd have a drink and you were a two-fisted drinker and all that kind of stuff. And that was my image of myself. So I continue to drink. I did well in combat. We were talking about this. I was not an officer, but I got promoted to staff sergeant, which is an E6 in 4 years, mostly because the people in front of me went home early in bags. So it wasn't, that's just what happens. You get promoted because somebody leaves. But I did well, I think probably because of my gene pool. But then I went to the Pentagon. I was not prepared for going to the Pentagon because I'd be up drinking till 4 o'clock in the morning, dating somebody I knew from the local massage parlor. And if you're a staff sergeant at the Pentagon, that's like kind of like being the bathroom attendant. And their idea of a breakfast meeting was 5:30. My idea of a breakfast meeting was 11. So I knew that wasn't going to work out. I got out of this, and I went back. A buddy of mine, a gunny who was actually in charge of me in Vietnam, back in Louisville. We moved back to Louisville. He is married. His wife, Bunny, introduces me to a beautiful girl. I was engaged 6 times before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was never married because it never even got that far. But I was engaged 6 times, and every one of them was somebody I fell in love with in a film. I remember seeing Romeo and Juliet, and there was a girl that looked like Olivia Hussey, and so I was engaged to her for 3 months. So I would fall in love with the girl in the film, then I'd see somebody that looked like her. Well, this girl looked like Olivia Newton-John. And if you're young, Molly, you can Google these people and find out what they look like. But Olivia Newton-John was a hottie. And so And this girl looked like Olivia Newton-John, and we fell in love. She lived upstairs from my buddy, the Gunny, and his wife, Bunny, and Gunny and Bunny. And so we're out, we're drinking together, we're having a good time. She and I decide I got a job with an advertising agency. I'm writing, producing commercials. I'm winning awards for the stuff that I did. The job that I did required me to be there for maybe 2 hours a day because I could say I'm off working on a script or I'm doing whatever. And I did very good work in a very short time period. So I got some awards for my work, but, you know, I eventually got fired from that job for what they said was I'd missed 91 days that year. I said, is that a lot? So the showing up part was something like, I can't remember who was talking about showing up. It's been mentioned several times, but that's what I had trouble doing. Anyway, so this girl's name is Kathy. We're in love. We're talking about getting married. We just need to figure out what to do with her husband. And he was an attorney for an advance man for Nixon who was running for re-election. And so he was gone most of the time. I was an expert marksman on active duty. I went after him a few times with a shotgun. He was an attorney. He came after me a few times with a warrant. And but we stick in there. Alcoholics do not give up. We've got willpower. And I stuck in there until I got her out of this bad marriage. And and we're getting married. We were about 10 days away from the marriage. We had all of these wedding presents coming in. We were going to Key West for our honeymoon. We had it all set up. And I was a daily drinker. I drank Country Club malt liquor before I went to homeroom in the 10th grade. I drank at lunch. I drank all day. And by the time I got out of school, especially by the time I got back from Vietnam, I was drinking whiskey round the clock. So most daily drinkers, people drink all the time, don't have blackouts because it's all kind of in a gray zone. It's not distinct, but it's not blackouts. But I would go on a binge on top of the daily drinking now and then. I can't explain that, except I did it. And so apparently I went on one of these binges a few days before the wedding. I was not to be found. I don't think I was doing anything bad, but I don't know where I was or what I was doing. And my fiance again, and every time something happened to me where somebody said something that was going to in any way imply that I needed to correct something about myself, I took it as rejection and I just walked away. I quit everything. I became a big quitter after I started drinking. And this girl said, when I missed a couple of days, just 10 days from the wedding, she said, I haven't told you this, but my dad died of alcoholism. And I don't know how I attracted so many women that had alcoholism in their family, but she said, I haven't told you this, but because of that, it just makes me uncomfortable. I think we need to postpone this wedding and talk about this. So I took that as a rejection, and I was cast out. And the only thing, I was just about to be fired from that job for missing 91 days, and the only thing I could think of was how to comfort me. And there was, you know, I didn't do drugs very well. I couldn't drink any more than I was drinking. But when I was in Vietnam, they tried new things. I'd never had a Coors. They Coors for a nickel. Tried different things. They had a magazine over there I'd never seen before called Penthouse. And in Penthouse, it had this. Now, I had seen Playboy before I left. But basically, especially for those of you who are young who can Google and find a giraffe and three people together and a whatever. The closest thing I saw to pornography was the tribal section of National Geographic. So, you know, there was a picture of almost naked Marilyn Monroe in Playboy. I'd seen that. But in Penthouse, they had a more, you know, and I'm an intelligent man. They had this intelligent section called the Forum or Letters, where they discussed certain, you know, lifestyle differences. It was all academia, just, you know. And so we'd sit around over there, several grunts sitting around reading an article out of Penthouse, and there was a concept in there that I had remembered called a menage a trois. And so apparently I didn't speak French at the time, but this idea was one of those things, certain things stick with you. And so I had remembered this. I had actually brought it up several times, usually at intimate moments with my fiance, but her having formerly been married to a Nixon aide, she was a little conservative, so she wasn't going for that. And so now she tosses me out, and I decide I am going to comfort myself by having a menage in Louisville, Kentucky, 45 years ago. And there's another article in there that I had read, which I now realize I did not understand, and I bring this up because this is the kind of trouble you can get into without a sponsor. This other concept, This other concept was called lesbian. So,
to obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
I had decided if I was going to have this menage, I wanted the girls to like each other, so it would be good for me to go to a lesbian bar to find two women who wanted to be with me. In Louisville, Kentucky, 45 years ago. If you're not sure what's wrong with that concept, keep coming back. So now, how do you find a lesbian bar when this is a totally different life? The lyrics to My Old Kentucky Home, when I went to it back in the 60s, was one line was, "'Tis summer, the darkies are gay." That's about how much I knew about, I mean, we had no, that it's not those words anymore, but the point being, things have changed a great deal from the 50s and 60s, and we had no education in anything other than here's a girl and here's a guy. So I'm trying to find this lesbian bar. I stay in this apartment with 11 of us. We all know each other. We're all veterans, Marine, Army, Navy. Whoever gets up first on Sunday rings the bell and pops the keg, and we play volleyball out in the pool. If you're married, you usually bring your wife. If not, if you have a stayover, you introduce her to all your alcoholic friends to see if she fits in. We were all friends. And so, but these guys aren't going to know because they're all kind of square. And I'm now looking around, and where do you find a lesbian bar? So I asked a couple of people, and at the ad agency where I worked, there was a guy in the back, and he came out and said, "I understand you're looking for a lesbian bar." And I said, "Yeah." And he gave me the address of one, and I thought, well, how would he know? He was an art director, and apparently he knew. So so I go down to this place, and I told you I'd started smoking. I smoked L&M's, four packs a day, because of the couple that was walking through the woods on the cover. And I drink Wild Turkey 101, no water. It bruises the flavor. So so I'm sitting at a piano bar with a girl who is another veteran, but I can tell there's not going to be any menaging, and one guy playing the piano, and you know, and nothing's happened, and I think I've gotten some bad information. And I take another puff off my cigarette, take a little shot, and you know, you get that kind of come hither voice. You're about as sexy as you're going to get. And if anything's going to happen, it's going to happen now. And so I end up just about to leave when a door opened on the other side of the ballroom. There was something going on upstairs, apparently, that I didn't know about. And it opened up, and the most spectacularly beautiful redhead in a long flowing gown comes cascading down the stairs almost in slow motion. And there was a show called The Loretta Young Show, where Loretta Young cascades down the stairs. I don't know what color her hair was, because it was black and white. But it was like we just started towards the beginning. We meet in the middle of the dance floor. We're holding on to each other. We're dancing. We're making out. I cannot get enough of her. She cannot get enough of me. Her name was Erica. And so then I remembered my mission. You know, and it's when you fall in love like that, you'll kiss for a little while, and then you'll stop, and then you'll go back to kiss because you don't want this to go away. You've found real love. And so I remembered my mission. I said, "By the way, do you have a girlfriend who could join us tonight?" And Erica said, "Oh, you're into that." And I said, "Oh, yeah." And she said, "Why don't we get to know each other tonight, and we'll add somebody tomorrow?" I said, "Thank God I did not marry that Republican woman." And so so we're walking down 4th Street, which is kind of the main street, main drag, where all the movie theaters are, and we're going back to my place, and this is one good-looking redhead, and I'm looking forward to what she's going to look like in a bathing suit, or sans bathing suit, if we go out by the pool the next day. And we get back to my house, and two things. Drugs rears its ugly head again. This girl pulled out a pill big enough to choke a horse. It was called a Quaalude. It was a horse tranquilizer. And she said, "Would you care for one?" I said, "No, thanks. I don't do drugs." I took another couple pulls off the Wild Turkey, and two things happened. Erica passed out, and I found some equipment I definitely wasn't looking for. And after 3 or 4 days, I said, this is not right. This is the point at which I became a little lost, because Opie or Wally had never dealt with this in any episode. Well, the next week I got fired from that job for missing 91 days, and obviously my love life was not going that well, so I decided my problem was I was in Louisville, I needed to go to big town, and I had already applied for, and because of the awards I'd gotten, and I interview well, I'd gotten a job with the world's largest ad agency up in New York. So I leave Louisville, because Louisville is too small a town for me. I'm too hip, and I'm going up there, and I'm going to have a great life. And I'm now working, flying on Lear jets, and I'm staying at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and I'm staying at the Plaza Hotel, and I'm writing and producing Coca-Cola commercials, and I won some Clios, and I did good work. I did a spot. They bring out each Super Bowl with a football player and a kid. And so I did good work. I won a couple of Clios. I won an Emmy. But my drinking, and by the way, for you who are watching on there, I think those cameras make me look heavy. But my drinking was actually destroying my body at this point, because I was drinking so much and had been drinking that way nonstop for so long and really not eating. And I was given a great honor. I was the youngest creative director at this place, and I was in a studio, and I was there to produce some music. I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony, and then we didn't have computers, so it was a bunch of musicians and a bunch of singers, and I'm in there at 10 o'clock in the morning. I usually timed things so I could speak, and I drank enough in the morning, so it didn't, not too much, and that day, whatever happened, I could not talk, and I couldn't function. And I walked out of that studio, and I walked around to a corner, and there was a little bar, a hole-in-the-wall bar, and I walked in there, and the guy didn't know me, and he poured me a triple. And I wondered how he knew I was a two-fisted drinker. And I took that triple and spilled it all over the bar. And then I did something I had seen in Lost Weekend with Ray Milland, where he takes a towel and he uses his lever to pull the drink up to his mouth, and I got a triple down, and I got another triple down. And then I saw myself in the mirror, and I realized why he gave me that drink. I looked like a street drunk. I was 25 years old. And I wonder what happened to that kid who had all that potential, who so many people pulled for and so many people tried to help. They didn't fire me. What they do, you know, drinking was not a big thing in those days if you were creative anyway, if you're a writer. I had a bar in my office they paid for. What they did was transfer me down to Atlanta. But it didn't take long before I got into trouble with that, and I got fired. And I was in Atlanta in this basement apartment. I told you what happened during those last few months. By this time, nobody, even the people that I drank with, weren't going with me. And I got the eviction notice, and when you get an eviction notice, they give you 6 weeks or 2 months, and that's never enough time. And finally, I was evicted. And I go up to the liquor store, and the guy, and there was only one liquor store where I was in my walking area, and the guy said, we know that the last number of checks you've written are no good, and we just need to ask you not to come into our liquor store anymore. And as degrading and as humiliating as that was, the only thing I could think of, oh God, I hope he gives me that whiskey. And he did. He gave me a bottle of whiskey. And I walked out of there, and I walked around the corner, and there was a concrete landing, almost in slow motion again. That bottle fell out of my hand, hit that concrete, broke, and spilled over the ground. And I was more frightened and terrified and hopeless in that moment than I ever was in a firefight. And I was so angry at God, because I knew that I deserved to have this good life. Everybody told me I did. And I just kept going down and down and down. And I started screaming at the top of my lungs at God, God blank you, God blank you, God blank you. And something happened, and I just, this moment of peace came over me, and I said, God, help me. God, help me. And there was this scene that I had seen 50 times drunk from another film called Days of Wine and Roses. And it was actually more real than that street I was on, where Jack Klugman walks up to Jack Lemmon and says, I understand you need help. I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked up. At that point, I had a pair of yellow pants, yellow-brownish pants, I still have them in a box. This is all I owned. A blue polo shirt, some loafers with holes in the bottom, but I carried a .45. In my last few years, I'd gotten very paranoid. I thought somebody was after me, and I carried this .45. And I got it out, and I got ready to pull the trigger. And when I said, "God help me," that peace came over me, and I walked up to the phone booth on a street corner, and I called the operator. I didn't have a nickel or a dime. And because somebody on a public information committee had gone to Bell South and told them about AA, that woman knew where to transfer that phone call. And she transferred it to the central office in Atlanta, where a woman had just been working for a year or so. Her name was Helen. She was the manager of the central office. Last month, Helen spoke at my 36th birthday. And she's got 45 years because she helps alcoholics. And she sent out a guy who had read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had smelled, and I was going to the bathroom by myself, and I was sitting there with his gun, and this guy came out, and he was a railroad guy, and he had read the big book because he didn't lecture me. He didn't tell me about me. He told me about himself, and I believed him. And I did the most complete third step I've ever done that day, and I turned myself over to this guy named Ed. And Ed was a guy who was somebody I wouldn't normally associate with, as I told you, I'm hip. And Ed showed up in a plaid pants and striped shirt, bad ensemble, and a bad toupee, a pipe. He worked for the railroad. He was a year and a half sober, and he was living in a one-room apartment with a hot plate, but he had a brand new car. You know how we are. And so this is June the 8th, 1977, the year that Elvis died and Star Wars came out. And also, it was the first year that a lot of ATM machines were out. Apparently, I didn't know about them. They had failed to send me my card. And in his brand new car, which was a Pinto, but it was brand new, and still had the little sticker on the side, Ed stopped, and it was hot, and he said, "I'm going to use this card and go to this ATM machine, and I need to get $20. And I'm confused about it, but he said, "Will you be okay?" And I said, "Okay." And it's hot and the sun's coming in. I couldn't get the door open, and I threw up down the inside of his window. Brand new car. And Ed came out, and he gave me the same kind of love that Dave did when we had a problem with the room. He did whatever it took to make sure that I was okay. Ed put his arm around me and said, "It's going to be okay." He didn't talk about his new car or what I had just done. And if he hadn't done that, I wouldn't be here. And that's the kind of love I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. From that day until now, I've not been without a group of men who would do anything and everything to make sure I had the opportunity to work these steps, to stay in here, to do work with others, and to be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous and enjoy all the beauty and love and the spirit that we've celebrated here this weekend. Now, I had brain damage. It took me about a year and a half to learn how to read. I was homeless. I moved back to my hometown of Louisville just because I thought I would know somebody there. Somebody says when we take that third step, we have everything we need. Somebody lent me a car to drive to Louisville, wrote down the name of my new sponsor, who was another railroad man named Jack Sullivan, who used to speak and has passed since, but it was written on there. And I had enough money to go to McDonald's, enough money to make a phone call, and I got to the city line. I called Jack. Jack said, "You're going to meet a guy named Harry over at the Token Club," and dot, dot, dot. And from that day, I absolutely lived with these guys. There was a guy who had two cots. They didn't have a treatment center there then. There was a guy who had two cots in his basement. I slept in one, and I helped newcomers. When we get a new guy, we'd drive him out down that basement. And we had a doctor we could call if we needed to, but otherwise I would just stay up with them and help them get sober. And I learned unconditional love just by staying in that basement and helping other alcoholics get sober. And most of them would walk away. They didn't want what we had after they started feeling better. But I stayed sober. And then I had a job at the Token Club. This is one of those clubs where they have AA meetings, and I made enough to pay for my cigarettes. So I had room and board and cigarettes for that first year or so. I was told from the very beginning that we have the fellowship, which embraces us, but the program is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and beyond that, there are some traditions and concepts. And they told me that, and they told me it repeatedly. And I went to 9 meetings a week, and 9 speaker meetings, and one meeting that was a big book, 12-step, 12 tradition. It was where we actually worked the steps, and they would stay behind and help you work them. I didn't do very well working them during the first year or two because I had brain damage. I couldn't remember anything. But about a year and a half into it, but what I did have, and I would recommend this for the newcomer, is I had a job. In Louisville at that time, they wouldn't let, because of my brain damage, they wouldn't let me have a complicated job that required math or anything, like making coffee. But but at that time, if you came a day in Louisville, if you didn't smoke, it was mandatory that you learned how to smoke. And we had these ashtrays that were round, that were gold, blue, red, and green. They looked like Christmas tree colors. They were made out of some kind of corrugated metal where the ashes would chemically fuse with the metal. And my job was to take a Brillo pad and keep those ashtrays out there clean. And I was a good ashtray guy. And I learned about rotation when they came and said, we've got a new guy, and he's going to be the ashtray guy. And I said, I don't think so. And here's what they do to you. He said, no, 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 he needs this job to get sober. So what are you going to say to that? But he said, but we have a job for you. You're going to be the chairman. I said, I'm going to be the chairman? No, 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 the chairman. But I'm not stupid. There are only 10 ashtrays and there are 40 chairs. So this is a promotion. Eventually, my mind started clearing up. I started remembering some things, and I got to that root cause inventory they were talking about. I think it was the fourth one I did. I did them right off the bat, like Larry was talking about yesterday. I did one within 30 days, but didn't remember much. But after a year or so, I did one, and I got it down. And here's the deal. We talk about building a new life. When I walked in here, I gave you all the power in my life. You had all the power. You decided whether I could be happy or not happy. You could make me decide whether I had money. You could decide if I got... You had all the power. And that's the way I live my life. So because you didn't give me what you're not capable of giving me, I had resentments towards every human being that I practically knew. And because I felt God didn't accept me, I was very angry at God. So I was walking around, and the only areas I had trouble in my life was that I didn't like people or God. And I'm not really a big nature buff, so I was really... Other than fantasy, that's the only place that I knew how to live. And now I take this alcohol away, and I'm having difficulty. And I start going back, and I start making amends, and that's where the real miracles start taking place. And I go, and I apologize to that Baptist church where I thought God had rejected me. And I got up in front of it on a Sunday night and spent 5 minutes apologizing and asking if I could be a volunteer there for a while. And two things happened. One, I found that God doesn't live just in AA. God lives outside of here, and that I was a child of God, and that these people loved me unconditionally just like they do here. Not all of them understood exactly what I was doing, but they certainly made an effort. The second thing that happened, I had a couple, year and a half, 2 years at that point. I was trying to find a meaningful relationship, which wasn't going all that well. And in the church that night, sitting there, never having heard someone apologize to a Baptist church before or since, was a... was a beautiful blonde who was two things I wasn't looking for. She was a seminary student and a good girl. I was looking for a new dancer who needed spiritual guidance. But because God put me together, and every good thing that's happened to me is when I've been in the middle of doing a step or helping somebody, because I was there doing what I was supposed to be doing, that girl was this beautiful blonde. Was one of your Al-Anon old-timers, and she and I have been married as long as this conference has been going, 29 years. Her name is Barbara. Later on, we learned the traditions, which has helped us stay together all this time. And like I said, I was engaged 6 times but never married. So I love my wife now more than I did when we got married, and I'm hoping that she loves me. So... And I never would have found that had I done it or engineered it myself. I go on, the last amend that I made there was to this church that I had actually defaced. I was so angry at God. It was a big thing for me. And I went to Harvey Brown Presbyterian, and I go in there to apologize to somebody. And this is the place where my dad was buried Dad's funeral took place a couple of months ago. And I went in there to find somebody, and there was nobody in there. I couldn't find anybody. I go to the chapel, and I realized what I was there for. I had been angry at God. I had found people that I resented, and I had forgiven them as part of my amends. But I'd been asking God to keep me sober and thanking God at night, and I didn't trust God. I wasn't comfortable with God. I was still angry at God. And so I got down on my knees, and I just started praying, and I forgave God. And that may sound like an arrogant, presumptuous thing to say. But forgive in Aramaic doesn't mean to absolve. It means to change my mind. I said, I don't know who you are or what you are. I know you got me sober. And I need to forgive you, and I ask for forgiveness. And I had one of the most profound spiritual experiences I've ever had, where I felt like I weighed nothing, and I felt like there was a wind that was blowing through my heart, and I felt the same kind of celebration that we were singing up here this morning. And for the first time in my life, I didn't have a relationship with people. I didn't improve my life. I didn't recover. I had nothing to recover. I learned how to love you by staying in a cot with an alcoholic in somebody's basement. I learned how to love God by practicing the steps and going in and forgiving God. And when that happened, when I broke down the wall that was there between me and whatever powers out there, my life has never been the same. The knots were taken out of my stomach. The bricks fell off my back. And I felt like I belonged, that I was one of God's children. And here's the deal. I've been looking. I actually did graduate work in intercultural studies where I studied the Eastern religions. A lot of us did that in the 60s trying to find some answer. I think a lot of people do it now because but the big book says quite often we return to the religion of our childhood, and that's what I did. And I found out that I was wrong about everything. I was wrong about who God was. And the only thing I know about, what I love about AA is we don't have any experts in God. The only thing I know about God is what God has done for me. And so if I come in and say I was a drunk and I haven't had a desire for a drink in over 36 years, that's the truth, and that's the God that saved me. My God, I believe that I was introduced to my wife through this power. So many things have happened in my life through this power. And finally, I feel like I'm connected to this power, which is a great thing, because in our book it says there is one who has all power. That one is God. And what that did, no longer do I need to be angry and resentful at you because you don't do what I want, because you don't have the power to run my life anyway. The one who does, I'm connected to as a son. And the big book says if I do what my father wants me to do, I'll have everything I need to do it. And that has been the case. Shortly after that, that was my spiritual awakening. I start to realize who I am, that I'm a spiritual being having a human experience and not the other way around. And I'd always been looking for a spiritual experience like a high. Now I realize I am a spirit and I'm going to live here for a long time. When this body's gone, I'm going on. The big book tells me that. We will lose our fear today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. And I go to this retreat, and I do an annual house cleaning, which includes how I use my time, not only the resentments, but how I use my time. Because the big book says our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be a maximum service to God and the people about us. How can I do that if I only do that once? So I do it once a year, and the guys I sponsor do it once a year so that I can continue to grow. And this group that I learned this from went to Gethsemane, which is a Trappist monastery. And one of the books I read was from Thomas Merton. He was one of the authors I read back in the day. And so we go there to have this retreat. I'm not Catholic, so I didn't understand everything they were doing. But he gives us communion, except that he didn't give us the blood. He gave us the body because he knew the blood might, for those of us who might not believe altogether, might start a toot. So anyway... that's not probably not the way that Catholicism is explained, but anyway, that's the way we did it. So we're in there, but this priest who was a cocky Irish guy gets up and he says, you boys are always talking about doing God's will. Now, I've had this spiritual awakening. I'm ready to find out what God wants me to do. And he says, God's will is simple. It's to do the best you can right now, this moment, with what you have to be useful to others. If you are a husband, be a good husband. If you're a son, be a good son. If you're a father, be a good father. If God got you sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, be the best AA member you can possibly be to help others in AA. If you have a job that you absolutely love, do it honorably and help others until God gives you something else to do. If you have a job that you absolutely hate, do it honorably and help others until God gives you something else to do. He said, God sees us, his children, the same way we see our children. And if you guys had two boys, they're both 7 years old, and you both give both of them little red wagons, and one of them takes that red wagon around the neighborhood and spreads joy and uses it for the benefit of the other kids, and the other one takes that red wagon and kicks it aside and said, I want a scooter, who would you give more to? The one who was grateful and used the gift you had given him. And I had always been the guy that took whatever you gave me, whatever life handed me, and set it over here because I wanted something else, and I figured out a strategy to get what I thought I wanted so it would take care of me. And that changed my life. Today, knowing that we can be useful no matter what, has made all the difference. 3 years ago, Barbara and I were speaking at one of these roundups, and somebody broke into our house while we were there. And we had already, because of my cancer, downscaled immensely, and they took most of what we had that was worth something. And I didn't feel any great loss, because my worth is not based on how I dress, how I look, what I own, what I drive. It's based on the fact that I am a spiritual being who has some experience that can help others. And Barbara and I could live in a one-room apartment with a hot plate, like the kid that saved my life when he called on me, did the 12-step call, and we could be useful to others. And I know that my Heavenly Father would love me. And because I am useful, you appreciate the fact that I'm useful to you. So the only things I was looking for from you in the first place was that you would appreciate me, want me to be with you, love me, be my friend. And everybody wants to be the friend of somebody who is useful. Everything I was looking for in every place I went was here in Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of just working those steps. And sometimes being grateful is more difficult than others. In 2005, Barbara and I we weren't able to have children. We put our dog, who we'd had for 18 years, a Norwegian elk hound named Booger Bear, and he was like our child, and we had to put him to sleep. And we sat and cried and thought, we'll never cry about that like anything else. And he taught us how to grieve. And within a very short time, within 2 months, Barbara's mom and dad died within a week of each other unexpectedly. We were the caretakers for them. They had Alzheimer's. And my mother died a month later. And in the middle of that, I was diagnosed with esophageal cancer, which is 99% fatal. So now, I can't tell. We did the best we could, and we appreciated the fact that Barbara's mom and dad probably didn't want to be here with that Alzheimer's, and they had gone to paradise, and we were grateful to be that they were there. We just had to let go of them. And we knew the same thing with our dog. There's a thing called the Rainbow Bridge, which you go over, and your dog's going to be waiting for you on the other side, and it gave us comfort. And then my mom died, and she had dementia from lack of blood flow, and she didn't want to be here like that either. And it was a loss, but we were able to deal with it because of what you taught us. And we were actually less disturbed with that, or I was, than I was when I was 8 years sober and I thought somebody in my home group was disrespecting me by saying something bad about me. I mean, that's the growth. When I get to the point where I trust my Heavenly Father and I love you instead of depending upon you for my happiness, things change a great deal. And that's the goal here. So, in the middle of this, I'm told this. We went to the International in Toronto. I come back. I go to a physical. I'm told I have esophageal cancer. Esophageal cancer is 99% fatal. It usually, they told me, if you can find someplace, there's a new procedure that they developed at the University of Southern California, a Dr. Tom DeMeester, where he takes all of the, they took like 30 lymph nodes and your whole esophagus, everything out of your chest. Take 2/3 of your stomach out, build a tube, put it back in there. I was on a feeding tube for 2 years, all of this, everything great. So I'm going to go out to USC. Lynn W. and other people were out here helping me with making some arrangements, and they called and said, we can't take your insurance. Now, I've enjoyed the sunlight of the Spirit for a long time, but I'm in a dark spot now because I'm going to die because God can't deal with getting the right insurance for this place. I don't know how. My choice. I chose not to think God was going to help me. And I went into this dark spot, and I was speaking in Key West on Saturday night, and I'm down there, and I can't pray, and a friend of mine who was down there said, just say any prayer you can remember. And I had memorized the 23rd Psalm. I'd used some in Vietnam, but I memorized it to read to the PTA in the third grade, so I started saying it over and over, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And I kept saying it and saying it and saying it. Right before I went up, I remembered the phone call I had with my original sponsor, Jack Sullivan, after he had been diagnosed with 6 malignant brain tumors and when he knew he was going. And I said, Jack, I don't hear any fear in your voice. He said, if God has been this good to me here, just imagine what he's got waiting on the other side. And I got up because what I accepted, I don't think I can ask for a new car or to be healed. I can ask, but it's God's choice. What I accepted was, if the worst thing that's going to happen to me is I'm going to paradise and get an, when I go in, there are going to be people singing like they were this morning. and I'm going to be sitting with my friend Keith Lewis and with my dad and with my sponsor and these other people. That's my idea of heaven. If that's the worst that's going to happen to me, my only concern was taking care of Barbara, and I knew God could do that. And I let go. And I came back on Monday, and I got a phone call from USC. And the way I write things, the sun would have kind of shined through the window there in Demeester, and the people said, we don't care about his insurance. We'll take him. And, you know, that's not what happened. And they said, we still can't take you, but our chief of surgery just left and went to Rochester, New York, to the University of Rochester, and he's the chief of surgery at that university and at the Hospital Strong Memorial. And we've sent your records to him. So 2 hours later, I call and talk to the chief of surgery at this hospital in Rochester, New York. And he said, we don't care about the insurance. You're a good candidate for this, and I want to teach this procedure to the people here. Can you come up? Now, I have to tell Barbara that I've got cancer. Prior to this, I told her I had some tissue that needed to be removed. And, wait a minute. I didn't lie. I didn't lie, but I'm not going to tell a woman who just lost her mom and dad or dog that I got a terminal disease and there's no hope. So I find out that I've got some hope, and like the ribbon that Tony gave me here that says hope, and I call up there and I talk to this guy, and he says, come on up. So now I need, and I hadn't told Barbara, which meant that I hadn't told you, because you don't gossip. And so the only people that knew were my prayer partner, Keith, another guy that I prayed with, Ed, Big Ed, and my sponsor, my sister, the doctor nurse, because she was working trying to find some help, and the medical people. And so it was a small group, and we were working, but we found an answer. Now I tell Barbara, now she's going nuts, but we're going up to this place where we don't know anybody. But because we had been active in this program and worked hard in this program and got to know a lot of people, when we arrived in Rochester, there were 23 people at the hotel, AAs and Al-Anons. They were our new home group for Al-Anon and for AA. They took care of us. They took care of Barbara. They got her out of the hospital room. They made sure that her laundry was done. We were there for a few months. We walked into the hospital the next day to meet with the doctor. And before we went to the doctor, we went into the chapel. And there on a wall, it was 30 feet deep, letters 2.5 feet deep, it says, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And we walk out into the lobby to see where God has brought us, and it's Strong Memorial Hospital, endowed by Dr. Leonard, the family of Dr. Leonard Strong, who was Bill Wilson's brother-in-law. Without whom I wouldn't have been here at all, because I would have been dead earlier from alcoholism. My experience is this, that if I just keep it simple, I help other alcoholics, I do what God asked me to do, I have all the power that I need to overcome anything. And I've seen it time and time again. We went to the first meeting down in New Orleans after Katrina, and they didn't know whether they could get anybody there, and they had 1,000 people, and they took over a school. Whether it's Katrina or cancer or any other thing, there's a power here that's greater than whatever you're going through. That wasn't what I bargained for when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the life that I had always wanted if I would have imagined one. And all I had to do was to reach out and grab the hand of the man in front of me, because I certainly didn't understand this when he was talking. The first live speaker I ever heard when I was 10 days sober was a guy from California who'd come to speak at the intergroup dinner named Chuck Chamberlain. And he got up at the podium and he kind of lanky like this. And I don't remember anything he said because I have brain damage. But I remember him talking about God, and I remember this look where he just looked like whatever he had is something I wanted. And I've heard people like that, and I followed people like that. And because of that, my dad, we went home to have Christmas with my dad and found out that he was dying. He didn't know. We didn't know. We went home for hospice. We didn't have Christmas. We had hospice. And one day the pastor came in from his church and was talking to us, and he brought an article from the church about Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, what's that doing here? The pastor had asked my dad what he wanted to donations made to when he died. And my dad, and we had to struggle to rebuild a relationship. I knocked him down on the stairs when I came back from Vietnam, and we were estranged for a long time. But because I followed the amendments that you told me to do, we were friends. And 4 years ago, my little brother, who's not at all like me, got sober. So he now has 4.5 years. And because of that, my dad said, well, the one organization that I know that does more good for people than anything else in the world is Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is the man who didn't want to claim that I was his son after I'd been arrested so many times. There's no way that I can thank you for what you've done for me or for Barbara. My only wish is that you have as many blessings or more than we have, and the way to get it is just grab the hand of the person in front of you. Thank you.
Enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.